Good morning, everybody. It is week 13 of the legislative session. Just kidding. It's week four. It feels like week 13. We've been rocking and rolling here in Tallahassee, and lots of bills have been moving through the first 3 weeks, and week four is shaping up to be another busy week as well. Thank you for joining us for today's Monday morning call-in. For those new to the call-in, we start the call with each of the lobbyists discussing the key bills they're watching this week and where we need your help on the advocacy front. Once each of the lobbyists have shared their updates, we'll open the call for questions. If you'd like to ask a question, press star 9 on your phone. This call is being recorded, and we'll send a recap email after this call with a summary, as well as a link to the call's recording. So we're going to jump right in here. I'm going to turn it over to Amber Hughes to kick us off with a finance and tax report.
Thank you, Casey. Good morning, everyone. The first issue to talk about today deals with law enforcement officer recruitment and training benefits. This is House Bill 3 by Representative Leak. It is up today in the House Appropriations Committee. We do support this bill. It is the bill that would create a new recruitment bonus program through the Department of Economic Opportunity that would be funded by state appropriation. The bill additionally gives collegiate credit for specific training and does those types of things with no cost to the city. The second set of bills I want to talk about today are proposed new additional homestead property tax exemptions that are for certain critical public employees. The joint resolution is House Joint Resolution 1, and the implementing bill is House Bill 1563, both by Representative Tomkow. They are up today in House Ways and Means Committee. If the constitutional amendment is approved by voters, the implementing bill would give an additional $50,000 homestead exemption that would attach between $100,000 and $150,000 of assessed value for law enforcement officers, firefighters, U.S. Armed Services members, Florida National Guard members, corrections officers, and state social workers. So we do have some concerns with the bill. The fiscal impact for all non-school levies is about $83 million. This is the second stop for that bill. And so with that, I will hand it over to David.
Thank you, everybody, and good morning. This morning, wanted to talk to you about two different issues. First one is dealing with sovereign immunity, and the bill numbers for these are House Bill 985 by Representative Beltran and Senate Bill 974 by Senator Gruters. And wanted to explain to you, under current law, Florida cities and all government entities enjoy the benefits of sovereign immunity, and that caps our litigation exposure to $200,000 per person and $300,000 per incident. Both of these bills seek to expand those limits. However, the House and Senate have taken drastically different approaches to trying to accomplish that. The House bill is going to be up this afternoon in the House Appropriations Committee, and the League of Cities is opposed to this bill. It seeks to increase limits to $1 million per person. As drafted, this would have retroactive application to any pending claims that haven't settled by the effective date of the bill. It would also tie this $1 million per person to a CPI so that every year that number could go up with inflation. And lastly, it would prohibit insurance companies from conditioning the paying out of any claim to the passage of a claims bill. So that would be a very troubling provision as well. So this bill is going to be up this afternoon at 3 o'clock. The League of Cities is opposed to this bill, given that it would have dramatic exposure to taxpayers to have to pay out these claims. I had mentioned the Senate bill had taken a very different approach. And so that's Senate Bill 974 by Senator Gruters. That bill is also going to be up at 3 o'clock today in the Senate Judiciary Committee. And that bill has an amendment that's been filed to it that makes the bill significantly better, in our opinion. It would take that $1 million per person with no per occurrence cap, and it's going to change that. And the new limit would be $300,000 per person and $400,000 per occurrence. It removes the retroactive application language. It removes that insurance language that I was telling you about. and it would, instead of having an annual CPI increase, it would say that every 10 years, CPI should be looked at and that sovereign immunity could go up on a decade basis rather than a yearly basis. So we support that amendment that's going to lower that to from $1 million to $300,000 and $400,000 respectively. And if that amendment gets adopted, we would be neutral on the Senate bill. So that's the update on sovereign immunity. And then I wanted to talk to you and just put on your radar a couple issues dealing with workers' compensation and benefits for first responders, specifically dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD. A couple of years ago, a bill was passed and introduced that went ahead and expanded PTSD coverage for our first responders. Two bills are being discussed on Wednesday in the Senate Banking Insurance Committee that seek to either clarify or expand those coverages for our first responders. The first bill is Senate Bill 664 by Senator Bradley, and essentially that bill would expand the available people that could benefit from the PTSD workers' comp coverage, and it would now include for our first responders being employed at the local level, anybody working part-time as a first responder, and anybody working as an auxiliary officer to be able to receive that PTSD coverage. That bill also expands that to correctionals officers as well, so that's mainly a state issue there. The other bill that's up also that deals with PTSD is Senate Bill 1066 by Senator Burgess. And essentially, this bill deals with extending the amount of time that a first responder has to file a claim. Under current law, they have a certain amount of time to file a claim from a qualifying event. This would expand that to say that it could be either that certain amount of time from the qualifying event or, in the alternative, after they're diagnosed with PTSD, a certain amount of time after that diagnosis, whichever is later. If you have any concerns with either of those workers' compensation bills, please let me know. With that, I'll go ahead and turn it over to Jeff.
Thanks, David. Good morning, everyone. I want to talk to you about two issues, but three legislative bills. Up to date in regulated industries are Senate Bill 1702 by Senator Bradley and Senate Proposed Committee Bill 7042. Both deal with condominiums. The first bill deals only with the inspection time frame. That cost is bore by the association, and that bill also specifies when local governments must receive inspection reports. The proposed committee bills takes on those changes and also expands requirements for disclosures to each condo unit, the local government, as well as potential home buyers. And it lays out guidelines for reserve amounts for the condominiums. And then one bill that we are supporting that's up on Wednesday in Transportation, Tourism, Economic Development Appropriations, Senate Bill 788 by Senator Hooper. It creates the Florida Hometown Hero Housing Program, which frontline workers, public safety, and educators would have access to special financing for housing. And with that, I will turn it over to Rebecca.
Thank you, Jeff. Good morning, everyone. Before I start talking about what's going on this week, I'm going to just give a quick recap of what happened with Senate Bill 620 last week, the business damages bill by Senator Hudson. This bill passed the Senate with a substantial amendment that changes a lot of the provisions in the bill for the better. The league supported that amendment. And when the amendment went on the bill, as a result, we part of our negotiations with the bill sponsor and Senate leadership, we decided to move to a position of neither support nor oppose the bill at this point. And just a quick summary of what it does. The bill authorizes a business, a private not-for-profit business, to present a claim for business damages if the local government ordinance has caused or will cause a reduction of at least 15% of the business's profit as applied on a per location basis of a business operated within the jurisdiction. The other requirement for the business to submit a claim is that it must have been engaged in a lawful business within the municipality or county for the 3 years preceding the enactment of the ordinance, before the bill had provided that the business could be operating anywhere in the state for 3 years. Now it has to be operating within the specific jurisdiction. The bill also provides for limitations on future damages with an outward cap of 7 years, depending on how long the business has been operating within the jurisdiction. So the amount of future damages is directly related to the how long the business has been in operation. So if they've only been operating in your city for 1 year, the greater, the furthest amount they could get future damages on would be 1 year. The bill also provides a procedure for submitting a claim with some specific timeframes for the business owner and for the local government. It also authorizes courts to award attorney's fees and costs to either party that prevails in a claim if it comes to that. Importantly, the bill provides an opportunity to cure for the local government to avoid going to court altogether. So in order to avoid liability, the municipality or county can, within 120 days of getting an offer to settle from the business, can either repeal the ordinance in question, amend the ordinance in question, or grant a waiver to the business from the enforcement of the ordinance. The other notable change in the bill is that it adds some pretty important exemptions that were not present in the underlying bill. For example, there is an exemption for ordinances or charter provisions that are expressly authorized by state or federal law. There is also an exemption for ordinances relating to budget adoption or amendment, including any revenue sources that are necessary to fund the budget. It also exempts ordinances related to procurement, and it also clarifies an existing exemption relating to Chapter 163, the Growth Management Act, to clarify that it also would exempt ordinances relating to zoning, development orders, and development permits. Please note the bill is prospective. It applies to ordinances or charter provisions adopted or amended after the effective date of the bill. And that is a brief summary of what the bill as amended does. We expect that now that the Senate has passed that bill out of the Senate, and it's been amended to improve it, we expect that the House companion bill, which is House Bill 569 by Representative McClure, to start moving through the committee process. There's a potential that that bill could be heard in the House Local Administration Subcommittee this Wednesday at 11:30, but we won't know that until the committee notices its agenda, which is going to be at 4:30 today. I'm going to turn next to some of the bills that are on deck for this week. This afternoon in the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee, there are two bills that I wanted to call your attention to, one of which is Senate Bill 1418 related to PFAS by Senator Albritton. This is a bill that is supported by the League. It was on that committee's agenda last week, but it got temporarily postponed. So it's back up again this week. We're going to support that bill. In addition, there is another bill, 1940, by Senator Broder relating to statewide flooding and sea level rise resilience. This bill adds additional provisions to improve the process that the legislature established last year for local governments to obtain funding for flooding and sea level rise resilience projects. There's also a bill on the agenda in that committee dealing with a study to establish a statewide long-term recycling goal by Senator Stewart. That is Senate Bill 1156. We also support that bill as well. Another thing to keep an eye out for, as I mentioned, the House Local Administration Subcommittee meets on Wednesday. They noticed their agenda this afternoon at 4:30. We expect to see another bill on that agenda dealing with solid waste. It is House Bill 1944 by Representative Hawkins. Many of you may have been experiencing problems with recycling or garbage pickup with your contracted solid waste or recycling vendor. This bill would prohibit you from requiring the vendor to pay liquidated damages when they fail to pick up the garbage or pick up the recycling. It also during a state of emergency, either state, local, or federal declared state of emergency. The bill also, outside of the emergency context for contracts going forward, would cap liquidated damages that you could assess against a vendor for non-performance at 50% of what is billed to the customer. We oppose that bill. We're working on amending the bill and narrowing its impact. There will be an amendment that is going to be filed to the bill that would remove contracts relating to storm-generated yard debris from the scope of the bill. And it would also tie the non-performance of the vendor to a non-performance issue that was caused by the state of emergency. I am looking for information from any of you out there that can let me know if your jurisdiction has been experiencing problems with your contracted waste or recycling provider relating to residential pickups. And if that is the case, please email me at some point soon. Hopefully Mary will include my email address in the summary that goes out following our meeting today. And with that, I'll turn it over to Tara Taggart. Thank you.
Thank you, Rebecca, and good morning, everyone. A few bills to put on your radar for this week. Up tomorrow is JDC2, which is a committee bill that just came out of the House Judiciary Committee. It's dealing with legal notices, and it's one that we support. So what this bill is essentially allowing local governments the option to now publish public notices on a publicly accessible website. And yes, this includes the government's own website. If certain conditions are met, those include, you know, you have to go through the public hearing process to make sure there's, you know, the change would result in the cost savings for the local government and that there's sufficient internet access in the area. If you choose to make this switch, you would also have to give an annual notice in a print newspaper or another publication that residents can have public notices mailed directly to their home if they so choose. This bill also reverts the qualified newspaper criteria back to what was pre-House Bill 35, which passed during the 2021 session, but just went into effect of January 1 of this year. So we can just scrap that and go back to the criteria you've always been using before, about 30 days ago. So these changes are one that we support, and it would result in a cost savings to many local governments. Up on Wednesday in the Senate Community Affairs Committee, it's Senate Bill 512 by Senator Burgess. That's the vacation rental bill. We remain neutral on the Senate bill, and this is the one that essentially, if you are a grandfathered city or your ordinance was adopted prior to 2011, you still get to maintain that grandfather. You can also amend your ordinance to be less restrictive. If you fall into that post-2014 category, the bill is essentially saying local governments can have a local registration program, and it can include certain components, you know, pay a fee of $50, have a point of contact, someone that can respond to issues immediately, comply with all state and state licensing and tax requirements, et cetera. It also has some new accountability measures on DBPR. So we will see that one in Community Affairs on Wednesday. Just an update on the House companion, that's House Bill 325 by Representative Fisher. It was heard last week in the House Regulated Industries Committee. It passed on a party line vote. And there was an amendment that went on this bill that has changed our position to oppose on the House bill. And essentially what that amendment does is it changes from the Senate version to say that basically, so follow along with me here, if you're in that post-2014 category where you do not have a grandfathered ordinance, the amendment essentially says that those local governments can maintain the fee that they currently have in place, but it's basically grandfathering that fee in and saying that it cannot be lowered, it cannot be increased, only reduced or eliminated, and then any future local government that wants to adopt a local registration program would not be allowed to charge a fee for doing so. I know that gets squirrely, so feel free to follow up after the call with any questions, and I'm happy to walk you through it. So we are opposed to the House bill now. Also up in Senate Community Affairs on Wednesday, Senate Bill 1420 by Senator Burgess. It gives a public records exemption for the personal information of city and county attorneys, as well as assistant city and county attorneys. And then finally, one that we will see on Wednesday in the Senate Governmental Oversight and Accountability Committee, Senate Bill 828 by Senator Hudson, titled Critical Infrastructure, and we oppose this bill. Essentially, what it is doing it mandates that any asset owners, so that kind of goes on to describe these as any local government that has a, you know, a water utility, sewer, electric, transportation, pretty much any asset that touches technology, which you can think of how broad that scope would be. And then it also says it includes, but it's not limited to, so lacks some clarity in that area. But any of those infrastructure pieces would have to comply with the ISA 62443 series of standards by July 1, 2024. And then any procuring automation and control components that would go with those assets would also have to comply by these standards by July 1, 2026. With that, I will turn it back to you, Skip.
Thank you, Tara. As you can see, we've got a lot going on this week. We're going to transition into the question segment of the call. If you'd like to ask a question, please press *9. And then when it's your turn to speak, please start with your name and the city that you represent. So to repeat, if you'd like to ask a question, press *9. And then start with your name and the city that you represent.
Hi, this is Sherry Simmons with the City of DeBary. We're obviously really concerned. I just came back from Tallahassee. I was there last week about Senate Bill 280, and I appreciate your work on getting those exemptions in there. But getting these economic development studies, if we want to have a dog leash ordinance, is kind of excessive. You know, is there further work we can do and on this? I don't know what else we can do. You know, I've spoken with our senators. In fact, on Saturday, I was speaking with my senator. So I'm not sure what else the league can do, but I think this should be a big oppose. And I know it's the Senate president's priority, and they're positioning it as small business protection. But this is bad, especially for small cities that are going to have to shell out money to have these studies done.
Thank you for that. This is Rebecca. I'll respond to that comment. Yes, we understand that given that nobody is currently required to do a fiscal impact estimate for any ordinance, the idea of having to start doing that can seem daunting. But keep in mind that this is a requirement that the legislature imposes on itself and has been doing so for a number of years. The amendments that were made to the bill, fortunately, will scale back what was originally required in the bill for these fiscal impact statements. First of all, and importantly, they do not have the effect of law. Okay, it is just a requirement that you do it. And it is not going to be the basis for somebody to challenge the assumptions and the data and the methodology that you include in your estimate. The estimate is intended to be just that. It is your best estimate of a ordinance that could possibly affect business, and how you determine that is totally within your discretion. So there are two requirements in the bill that I imagine if you do one time, you're not going to have to do them again every time you adopt an ordinance. The first of which is how many businesses in your jurisdiction are likely to be affected. That number is not going to change significantly over time, maybe on an annual basis. So you won't have to generate that data anew every time you do an ordinance. Secondly, you have to state the purpose of the ordinance and whether it relates to a public purpose. That's generally something that you're doing already when you propose an ordinance. The other factors that are required to be considered are what is the likely impact of businesses to be affected by the ordinance. So taking the example of the dog leash ordinance, I think if you were to reach out to the local Chamber of Commerce and ask them, does this ordinance affect you? They would probably say no, in which case your response would be, or at least that you would handle that, is you would say fiscal impact as it relates to how many businesses it would affect would be either indeterminate or none. And then lastly, the fiscal impact requirement portion of the bill requires you to state whether or not any new fees are going to be imposed by the ordinance. That doesn't take an economist to figure that out. You just state whether there is going to be a fee associated with it or not. So it is definitely not designed to make you incur costs associated with hiring somebody specifically to do these estimates. And again, I want to stress it is intended to be just an estimate. And so please keep in mind, you know, that do it, take your best shot at it, but it is not meant to be required with mathematical precision. I hope that helps.
Okay. Thank you. I don't know if you could still hear me, but thank you. I just know, you know, chambers charge when you ask them for to do things for you, but I think the estimate, and it doesn't have to be perfect, is a help.
Yep. Thank you.
Next question.
Hi.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Good morning. This is Hazel Rogers, Mayor of Lauderdale Lakes, Broward
Hey,
County.
Mayor.
Hi. How are you? I don't know. I know you did not mention this morning, but I was trying to see where that net metering bill is as it relates to solar. Is that still a possibility for this session? What happened to that bill? I was following it, and now I don't see it.
Thank you. Representative, thank you for that question. The net metering bill has not moved in the House. It has been referred to three committees. So the current committee that it sits in is the House Tourism and the Tourism Subcommittee. I can't remember the exact name of it. This is week four of session, which I know you're quite familiar with. And so after week four, subcommittees stopped meeting. And so if that bill doesn't get a hearing this week, then the only way it could have any further life in the House is if it got withdrawn from that committee, which could happen. I expect that there may be some maneuvering behind the scenes to try to keep that bill alive. But so far, I take encouragement from the fact that it hasn't moved in the House. The Senate bill has been stalled for several weeks. It had a first hearing in the Senate, has two more committees to go through. It's actually in the Senate Community Affairs Committee right now, which is the committee that is chaired by the bill sponsor, Senator Bradley. It is telling to me that that bill has not been put on an agenda, and it's not on the agenda this week. Obviously, that committee is going to continue to meet for several more weeks, so I can't say that it's not moving, but I don't think it is on what I would characterize as a fast track.
Hey, that's good to know, and thank you. Help me monitor
that. Keep the pressure
up.
Keep the pressure up.
Thank you, Mayor.
This is Richard Bryan from Daytona Beach Shores. If the smoking bills become law, is there potential liability under the business bills? If the local governments regulate smoking in parks or on beaches?
This is Rebecca again. Unless you have some cigarette vendor out there on your beaches selling cigarettes, the answer would be no.
What about, say, a cigar store, for example?
Do you have any cigar stores on your beaches?
No, I'm asking this for other people, too. I don't know that we would have a cigar store.
Yeah, I think I would think that it would be hard to trigger that 15% or to hit that 15% threshold in profits and then tie it directly to the ordinance, the smoking prohibition or the creation of a smoke-free zone at a playground, I think that would be a stretch, tying those two bills together. And I also think that with the inserting prevailing party in the business damages bill, we think that's going to cut down on a lot of the potentially bogus claims that would come forward when it was one-sided fees. And so I don't see the impact. I don't see the smoking bill or adopting an ordinance regulating smoking around parks as leading to a bunch of business damage claims.
This is Rebecca.
Yeah, I agree with that, but there's nothing that would preclude them bringing that claim, right?
This is Rebecca. Yes, there is. What would preclude them from bringing that claim is that they run the risk of having to pay your attorney's fees when they lose on a claim that has a tenuous, at best, link to the ordinance that you are enforcing. So I think in the example of the smoking on the beaches situation, it is the nexus between any conceivable damages that a cigarette or a cigar store owner would be facing from that would be extremely difficult to prove. You've got a number of defenses at your disposal in determining what the damages are. And the fact that they would be on the hook for paying your fees is a substantial deterrent for somebody trying to bring a claim like that.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. When I said preclude, I meant there's no legal reason that they would be precluded, right?
People can sue for any reason whatsoever. It is a fiscal, it is a financial decision and based on the odds and the assessment of winning a case.
No, I understand that. Okay.
Yep.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, this is Carol Carter, City Commission, City of Anna Maria. I'm concerned about, I don't understand what Tara Taggart said about House Bill 325, that you are, the league is opposing the amendment that cities like us could retain our 2014 rules with regard to health and safety and charging for inspections, et cetera. Did I understand that correctly, that you oppose us being able to keep our current ordinances in place?
Hey, good morning, Mayor. Thank you for that question. And I apologize if I wasn't clear on the amendment that went on House Bill 325 last week. I know it's a bit of a path to follow now that there's kind of essentially creates them as three different categories of how your city would fall into this bill. So it gets a little squirrely. But for your city's example, we're looking at the post 2014 category. Everything remains the same as the complying with the local registration program. The only changes that were made were to alter how the fee could be charged and then also to create basically a 30-day cure period if a property owner failed to register with the local government. But it otherwise remains the same. We'd be, the way we're reading it, we'd be preempted on having occupancy limits in place under this local registration program, and then it could only look like what the bill authorizes instead of right now where we basically can only, not do three things, which is zone, regulate duration, as well as frequency. I know it gets a little confusing, so I'm happy to talk more after this call and go through more of the details.
Yeah, and so
okay.
Just to add to
occupancy
add
is
that.
A real problem for us because that's part of our that's what we passed after 2014, limited occupancy.
And so you would be opposed to the bill before the amendment, and probably even more opposed after the amendment went on to the House bill last week.
Exactly.
And so our position on that House bill is consistent with your position.
Oh, okay. Okay. I didn't understand that. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. This is Bob Mayerson, Commissioner in the City of Parkland. Rebecca, I've got a question on these business damages bills. Does the businesses, do they also include home-based businesses?
Thank you for that. Yes, the bill uses
3 years.
The bill uses the term private for-profit business. So I think a home-based business would, you know, satisfy that requirement. But the question is, could the home-based business establish that they had been operating for 3 years in your jurisdiction prior to you enacting whatever ordinance they might have an issue with? So yes, conceivably they could. If they meet the criteria of having been in business for 3 years in your jurisdiction, it's a lawful business that they've been doing, and you don't currently have an ordinance that's regulating them. So remember, this is prospective, so it would only apply to an ordinance that you adopt or amend in a substantive way after the effective date of the bill. So there's a couple of factors that would obviously control the outcome or the answer to that question ultimately.
Right. No, I just was curious to find out if it include home-based businesses, because I know last session home-based businesses kind of had a little bit of a shift where what they could do or what they couldn't do. Allowing a little bit more, I guess, call it ability to do different things on somebody's property, where if we as a city would have to create an ordinance to prohibit that, which would be obviously affected to every resident, you know, in that area, there could be the home-based businesses that could challenge that. And especially in our community, we have areas that have, you know, acre or over acre lots. So could be challenging at some point in time. So yeah. I just was curious.
Well, also keep in mind, this is probably a discussion for you and your city attorney, but keep in mind there's also an exemption for ordinances that are expressly authorized by state law. And my recollection of that home-based business legislation from last year is that while it did preempt, it also specifically stated what you are authorized to do with respect to home-based businesses. And so that might also come into play as to, you know, whether the business qualifies and whether or not an exemption would just take it off the table.
Right. Okay. And then just a follow-up, or not a follow-up, but an additional question. The smoking bills in the parks and beaches, is that moving? Because I haven't seen it this week.
Yes. Good morning, Commissioner. This is Tara. So the Senate bill, which is Senate Bill 224, is not on the agenda this week in Environment and Natural Resources. However, we will not know the fate of the House bill, I guess, for a few more days now. So it is not scheduled, but it will be heard next in the Environment, Agriculture, and Flooding Subcommittee. I believe that agenda is due out by tomorrow at 4:30 p.m. So I would encourage you all, if you're on the call and you care about that House bill, please reach out to Chair Buchanan, who chairs the Environment, Agriculture, and Flooding Subcommittee, and ask him to agenda that bill.
We also expect the smoking bill to be up in the Senate next week. I think that there will be an amendment coming on that bill that was filed last year too. It's coming from Jason Broder, who's the chair of that Energy, Environment, Natural Resources Committee, that would exempt out cigar smoking. That's been an issue for him for the last couple of years, but I think that that bill will be heard next week, most likely in the Senate, with that amendment getting filed as soon as it's noticed.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, sir.
Good morning to everyone who's on the call. Thank you again. This is Philip Walker, President of FLC and City Commissioner for the City of Lakeland. Thank you again for what you're doing and will continue to do. And thank you to the staff, especially so as we approach almost the halfway point of this session. And look forward to seeing you all on next week for our FLC days. And again, hopefully everyone is registered, and we look to see you all, okay?
Thank you, Mr. President. And we agree with you. We hope to see as many folks as possible next week in Tallahassee for our legislative action days. That's going to be Tuesday and Wednesday, the 8th and the 9th. Got one. It sounds like we have one final question.
Yeah, good morning, everybody. This is Eric Gerard, Commissioner of the City of Largo. A question about House Bill 569, which, of course, is on everybody's mind right now. I understand that the prevailing party will be able to collect attorney's fees and such in any kind of case that goes to litigation. However, we're all taking a look at this and thinking, what's going to happen? Is it going to be a sue and settle environment where every, home-based attorney is going to find themselves with a nice cottage industry? And so what we're looking at is the possibility of being nibbled until it has serious impact on our ability to legislate and also our ability to pay for all of these. Has anybody taken a look at the sue and settle possibility here, where we will not litigate because litigation becomes very, very expensive? And then, of course, we're also tossing the dice on whether we would prevail. So how do we address that issue?
This is Rebecca again. So a couple of things to keep in mind. We specifically raised the issue of the sue and settle drive-by lawsuits issue and got some changes to the bill that will address the, or at least provide a deterrent to that. The exemptions I've mentioned, also the prevailing party attorney's fees. Somebody that thinks they have a claim, especially a claim that isn't clearly meeting that 15% threshold, you're not gonna accept their offer if it's pretty clear that they aren't even close to getting to that 15% mark. And if they choose to take you to court after that, then they will run the risk of having to pay your attorney's fees, because they're also going to have to provide you any records to substantiate their claim, all right, when they make you that offer. So you'll be able to take a look at what they're relying on to make the case for whether they're affected. The other thing is that once they submit those records to you, those are public. And so anybody that wants to see what that business's financial records are would have complete access to their records. I would think that in many cases, that alone would be a significant deterrent to filing anything but a very serious claim that has merit. So there's a couple of gems in there. Again, we're not supporting this bill. This is still still not a good bill. If you have additional concerns, if you have specific issues that are going on in your city that you believe are going to get caught up in this by the sort of the law of unintended consequences, keep in mind that there's a whole nother body of the legislature that has to move this bill through committee and pass it off of the floor. So I would focus any efforts and communications that you have at this point relating to House Bill 569 on your state representative and on the legislative delegation that you have in the House of Representatives, because that's where the movement and any further changes are going to come with this bill.
Well, thank you, Rebecca, and also thank you for your hard work on this very difficult bill. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. Well, seeing no further questions in the queue, appreciate everybody for joining us today. We're going to hit the ground running here in week four. We'll see you back next Monday at 9 a.m. for another Monday morning call-in. Thank you all. Have a great week.